Okay, this is Professor Tufano, and I'm talking about Chapter 12, Managing Conflict. This is Part 3 of 3. Again, Interplay, this is the Interplay book, and this is the 13th edition, and I'm starting on page 381. Conflict in Relational Systems. It says here, so far we've described individual conflict styles. Even though the style you choose in a conflict is important, your approach isn't the only factor that will determine how conflict unfolds. In reality, conflict is relational. Its character is usually determined by the way the people involved interact. For example, you might be determined to handle a conflict with a neighbor collaboratively, only to be driven to competition by their uncooperative nature or even to avoidance by their physical threats. So we've talked about that, about the context. Okay. So the book talks about conflict in two styles, symmetrical and complementary. So the conflict approach of partners in interpersonal relationships and even impersonal ones can be complementary or symmetrical. In complementary conflict, the partners use different but mutually reinforcing behaviors. In symmetrical conflict, both people use the same tactics. So they divide that up. And if you look on page 382, complementary and symmetrical conflict, they give you a situation, and then they give you some examples of complementary versus symmetrical conflict. Research shows that a complementary fight-fight approach is common in many unhappy marriages or shakarinis. One partner, most commonly the female person, addresses the conflict directly, whereas the other person, usually the male human, withdraws. And then they have this dance or this pattern, right, that happens. It says here, it's easy to see how this pattern could lead to a cycle of increasing hostility and isolation because each partner punctuates the conflict differently, blaming the other person for making matters worse. I withdraw because you're critical. And then the other person says, I criticize because you withdraw. And then this is just a big cycle of a pattern, which is a very dysfunctional cycle. Couples who use the demand withdrawal pattern report being less satisfied with their conflict discussions and that their negotiations rarely produce change. Yeah, that would probably make sense, right? Complementary approaches aren't the only ones that can lead to problems. Some distressed relationships suffer from destructively symmetrical communication. If both partners treat one another with matching hostility, one threat and insult leads to another in an escalatory spiral. If the partners both withdraw from one another instead of facing the problem, a complementary de-escalatory spiral results in which satisfaction and the vitality ebb from the relationship. So take a look at that table on 12.2. Let's spend some time on page 383. John Gottman, that's G-O-T-T-M-A-N, and the Gottman Institute, I would look them up if you would dive a little deeper on this because he came up with this description of what he calls toxic conflict and the four horsemen. Toxic conflict and the four horsemen. It says some conflict approaches are so destructive that they can almost guarantee to wreak havoc on relationships and making it very difficult for the partners to survive these kind of toxic interactions. Gottman has gathered decades of data with newlywed couples. Those are couples who got married, and in the early stages of their relationship, they have a term called newlywed, meaning they just were wed. And these couples, so he's done a lot of work with people in the initial stages of these semi-permanent couplings, romantic couplings. And it says here, he's gathered data throughout about their relationships and communication patterns. So he deals with or focuses on communication patterns. By observing interactions, Gottman has been able to predict with high accuracy whether the newlyweds will end up divorcing. He may have even been on a TV show called 60 Minutes, but I do remember seeing him on a television show where they have him on tape 10, 15, 20 years previous, where he was doing some type of either research or counseling with couples and predicted which ones would stay together and which ones would get divorced. And he had a very, very high prediction of how those relationships would be in the future. So basically, it was almost like people were going to him to kind of ask if they could predict if they're going to be able to stay together. So that was kind of interesting. But it says here that he has discovered that there are four specific destructive signs that he looks for to see how couples process those. And he calls these the four horsemen: criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling. And so he looked at these four, and he said that depending upon how the couples dealt with criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling can give us some type of prediction about their ability to maintain an intimate relationship, especially a mutually satisfying one. He called this toxic conflict and these four areas the four horsemen. Criticism. These are attacks on a person's character. it says here, for instance, I wish you had been on time. We're going to be late to the movies. And critical character assaults stated as evaluative. You're so thoughtless, you never think of anyone. Criticism. Secondly, defensiveness. It says defensiveness is a reaction that aims to protect one's presenting self by denying responsibility. You're crazy. I never do that. And counterattacking. You're worse than I am. You think you're bad. You think I'm bad. You're worse. Those kind of things. Although some self-protection is understandable, problems arise when a person refuses to listen to or even acknowledge another person's concerns. Contempt. A contemptuous comments belittle and demean. It can take the form of name-calling. You're a real jerk, or sarcastic barbs. Oh, that was brilliant. Contempt can also be communicated nonverbally, of course, through eye rolls or disgusted sighs, those kind of things. And lastly, stonewalling. Stonewalling occurs when one person in a relationship withdraws from the interaction, shutting down the dialogue and any chance of resolving the problem is in a mutually satisfying way. It sends a disconfirming message: you don't matter. So it says, here's a brief exchange illustrating how the four horsemen can lead to a destructive spiral of aggression. Okay, here's some statements. You withdrew from our account again. Can't you do anything right? Hey, don't blame me. You're the one who spends most of the money. At least I had better math skills than a first grader. Way to go, Einstein. Whatever. Well, walking out of the room, right? So that's a little bit of those four kind of interchanges there. It's easy to see how this kind of communication can be destructive in any relationship, just not a shakaroony or a marriage, a mirage. It's also easy to see how these kinds of comments can feed off one another and develop into destructive conflict rituals. Destructive conflict rituals. So they can feed off one another and develop into destructive conflict rituals. Those would be rituals that are destructive to the relationship. It says here, when people have been in a relationship for some time, their communication often develops into conflict rituals. Unacknowledged, but real, very real, repeating patterns of interlocking behavior. And then it gives a couple of common rituals. So these are behaviors that couples then lock into. And according to the book, it says they're unacknowledged, which means that the parties are not completely aware or conscious of those patterns. They just are kind of go-to patterns or go-to responses when they lock themselves into specific kinds of conflicts. And there's patterns that develop, and they're called interlocking behavior. Interlocking behavior. And the key here, if someone needs to needs to find a way to disengage from the behavior and be able to step back from the from the patterns and kind of break the chain from that repetition. It's hard because oftentimes people learn this from their original mothers and fathers or the original people that raised them, or they have modeled behavior in the home or in the place where they spent the most time, and they then repeat those patterns based upon that modeling, and they may or may not be aware of how dysfunctional they are and how damaging and toxic they are to relationships, especially in an attempt to process conflict, especially interpersonal conflict, those repeating patterns of interlocking behavior make it very, very difficult for parties to be satisfied. And when couples are dissatisfied, they then will ultimately withdraw. And it's very difficult to then re-engage because typically there's not a lot of motivation, because often the partners believe that nothing's going to change. And that would be the point of some type of counseling, where oftentimes professionals can help people see those rituals and that interlocking behavior. Okay, so it says, there's nothing inherently wrong with the interaction in many rituals. So that's true. Rituals are not necessarily bad in a sense, because some rituals could be good. Rituals can cause problems, though, when they become the only way relational partners handle their conflicts. Relying on one pattern to handle all conflicts is no more effective than using a screwdriver to handle every repair, or putting the same seasoning in every dish you cook. What works in one situation isn't likely to succeed in many others. Conflict rituals may be familiar and comfortable, but they aren't the best way to solve a variety of conflicts that are part of any relationship. Okay, that's on page 385. Moving on to variables and conflict styles. It says, by now you can see that every relational system is unique. The communication patterns in one family, business, or classroom are likely to be different from another. But along with the differences that arise in individual relationships, there are two potential powerful variables that affect the way people manage conflict. They talk about gender. We'll talk about gender. It says, and we'll just take a brief look at gender, because again, a lot of this stuff is evolving, but I still think a lot of this stuff is pretty accurate here. It says, some research suggests that men and women often approach conflict differently. Even in childhood, there's evidence that boys, on average, are more likely to be aggressive, demanding, and competitive, whereas girls are more likely to be cooperative and accommodating. Studies of children from preschool adolescents have shown that boys try to get their way by ordering one another around, like, lie down or get off my steps, give me your arm. By contrast, girls are more likely to make proposals. They may begin with, let's go find some, let's ask her if she has any bottles, let's move these out first. Whereas boys tell each other what role to take in the pretend play. Come on, you be the doctor. Girls more commonly ask what role they'd like to play. Will you be the patient for a few minutes or make a joint proposal? We can both be doctors. Furthermore, boys often make demands without offering an explanation. I want to play Xbox right now. In contrast, girls often give reasons to their suggestions. We got to clean them first because they got germs. Adolescent girls use aggression in conflicts, but their methods are usually more indirect than the boys. Whereas teenage boys often engage in verbal showdowns or even physical fights, teenage girls typically use gossip, backbiting, and social exclusion. This is not to suggest that girls' aggression is any less destructive than boys. Research suggests that these forms of female aggression continue in college and can occur online as well as in person. Gender differences in dealing with conflict often persist into adulthood. So some researchers studied the conflict behaviors late adolescents use with same-sex and opposite-sex peers. They found that compared with females, males use more competing behaviors with same-sex peers and more avoiding behaviors with opposite-sex peers. Regardless of the culture or the sex of the person with whom they're interacting, females are more likely than males to compromise. A survey of college students reinforced stereotypes about the influence of gender in conflicts. Female students describe men as being concerned with power and more interested in content than in relational issues. Sentences used to describe male conflict usually included the most important thing to males is their egos. Men don't worry about feelings. Men are more direct. In contrast, women were described as being more concerned with maintaining relationships during conflicts. Sentences used to describe the female conflict styles included women are better listeners, women try to solve problems without controlling the other person, and females are more concerned with other people's feelings. Okay, and then let me see. Moving on to page 389, and this will be the final section. This is the conflict management and practice section here. And again, if you do Google or look up other ways, other systems to manage conflict, there's all sorts of them that you could find. But I think most of them have at least these in mind. They define needs. They listen to the person. They generate possible solutions and implement solutions, follow up with solutions. I mean, probably all of them have those built in. This one is an okay one for sure. So if you are practically in the midst of some interpersonal conflict with someone who's close, and again, these could be friends, they could be family, or they could be intimates. I think that if you can get the other person to cooperate in the process, because oftentimes that's the number one problem. So you have a problem. Let's just say it's about spending time. We'll use that as a general kind of illustration. So you and your romantic partner, the conflict that you're currently dealing with is that either you need more time with that person or they need more time with you. So you're requiring more time than they're giving, or they're requiring more time than you're giving. So it could be from either perspective. For the sake of the lecture, I don't know. If you need more help, you could reach out to me personally, and I could kind of personalize this advice, so to speak. But say that was the issue of time. So then you're like, okay, I'm going to now share my concerns with my partner. So then you go to your partner and you say, hey, you think we could talk about some things? There's something bothering me, something that's important to me, and I want to talk to you about it. And then the person says, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know about it. Okay, so now you have two problems, right? You have one is the one that has to deal with time and how you're feeling your needs aren't being met, the expectations in the relationship as far as how much time we spend with one another or with friends or other people that you're not satisfied with. And now you bring that as a general concern, maybe even a specific concern. Maybe you just say, hey, look, I'm just not happy about the way that we're spending time, and I want to talk about it. And then the person says, I don't want to talk about it. It's fine. You're just making something out of nothing, and something along those lines. We've kind of all been there before, probably, right? So now the problem is, now I have two problems. I have one, I'm not getting my needs or expectations met in regards to how much time I'm either spending with them or they're spending with me, and now I bravely, in some cases, bring that to the attention of my partner, assuming or hoping that they will be open to this discussion and open to considering it and discussing it and ultimately resolving it, and then I get shut down. So I'm shut down. So now you see I have two problems, don't I? I have the one problem that has to deal with the time. Now I have the second problem that my partner is maybe not exactly demonstrating partnership type of behavior because they are refusing to even address my concern, talk about my concern. They're just avoiding it. They don't even want to talk about it. So you could see that in regards to this this idea of conflict management and practice, you have to have a willing partner that is able to hear your concern. hear the problem as it's stated by, in this case, you know, you, in a sense, and be able to be open to discussing it and finding some process that could help to ultimately resolve it. And on page 389, and then all the way through page 393, they have seven steps to practically manage and resolve an interpersonal conflict. So the big question that I always get asked is, how do you get past that second problem, in a sense? Or maybe it's actually the first problem, but you're not aware of it until you bring up, quote, a problem, and then realize you have at least two problems, maybe more than two, but for the sake of this discussion, if the question has to do with I have an issue regarding how much time we're spending together, not enough or too much or whatever, who's doing it, who's not doing it, basically it's about needs and it's about expectations, and then you bring that up and the partner just shuts you down. Now you got two problems. So the most difficult part is getting to that stage where the partner will cooperate in the process of fixing the problem, dealing with the problem, confronting the problem. And so that's the hard part. There's no easy answers there, because if you've partnered up romantically with someone who is a good person, just as a general term, that they may initially resist any attempts to discuss that, quote, issue or issues, and maybe after some time of reflecting and thinking and considering, and maybe giving them a couple of days or, you know, to kind of reconsider, maybe they'll come back and apologize for their dismissal, and they'll say, hey, I definitely want to hear you out, and I want to participate in the process of figuring out how to make this better for you, for us. But that is a very difficult place to be. So oftentimes, the character of the people that we have tentatively or semi-permanently partnered with, their character comes out once we ask them to partner with us in finding solutions to problems within the relationship. And again, it could be mutual. In other words, the problem could be a bit of both people's needs or expectations, or it could be more one than the other. They could be kind of unexamined expectations, where I expect my partner to always be available to me, and my partner doesn't share the same expectation, and we've never really discussed it. We've just assumed that we were in agreement, and now all of a sudden I'm feeling that my partner is ignoring me or not spending enough time on me, and then that becomes a point of contention. And then when I bring that up, the partner says, wait a second, that we never agreed to that, we never discussed that, and I just always assumed that this was the way we would divide up our time. And then now there's an opportunity to discuss that particular concern or issue. Again, we're going to just say time spent together. And then that the other person says is open to the conversation and maybe open to this seven step or something similar to that, but just open to discussing it. And then after you discuss it, the partner says, I still don't agree to that, and I don't think I should be spending 90%, 80%, 70% of my time with you. I like it at 30%. You wanted that 90%, and you know, now that we're discussing it in detail, this can now become a deal breaker, because although we like each other, this distribution of time is just something that right now I don't think is something I'm willing to offer or to do. And then you could see where there may be no ability to negotiate a better place for that. So that always is the difficult part, is getting an unwilling partner to become a willing partner, and trying to work together to resolve those issues. But sometimes, once these conflicts, these issues are brought to a head, they're also kind of clarifying issues. In some case, they clarify incompatibility between the partners. And in some cases, it's an opportunity to really be honest about differences and to negotiate better boundaries and a better understanding and to integrate the various expectations about the relationship. So in long-term romantic relationships, this happens a lot. Things are going smooth, and then there's some bumps, and then those are opportunities to talk through the issues or to resolve them or to clarify them. And so even though conflict could be scary, there's also a very positive component, is that oftentimes it helps clarify needs, it clarifies expectations, it clarifies the boundaries in the relationship, and so that's why ultimately you shouldn't be afraid of it. And it's best to, if you can talk about these issues early on in a relationship, to make sure that you're actually partnering up with individuals that are going to be open to communicating with these various issues that every couple has. Those are better partners. But sometimes we pick people, we don't think it through, and we then yoke with individuals we probably shouldn't, and now we're kind of, quote, stuck. And in some cases, you may be stuck for longer than you want to, or maybe you want to unstick rather quickly, and those kind of things. And so ideally, taking your time early to have various discussions about kind of the normative processes that good relationships go through, and that would be for sure being open, having open communication to address any and all issues when they're brought to the partner's attention. Resistance to process those issues or problems can just be indications that you picked or they picked the wrong person, so to speak. In some cases, it just has to do with the time and the place of the relationship. And so back to page 389. There's seven steps to resolving conflict in practice. Define your needs. Share your needs with the other person. Listen to the other person's needs. Generate possible solutions. Evaluate the possible solutions. Choose the best one. Implement a solution, and then follow up on the solution. So you'll find those various steps in almost every single conflict resolution system. It doesn't matter if it's at work or it's with family. You're going to find various pieces of those seven ideas, and they're all good. You can add an eighth or a ninth, but those are good. Define your needs. So figure out what the need is. Share that with the other person. Usually it's a need that goes unmet. So you could say that's the problem. So step one, I have a need that is unmet. Define that need. Next, share that unmet need with the other person who you believe should be fulfilling that need reasonably. Three, listen to the other person's need or the other person's response or perspective into how they perceive your need. And then four, generate possible solutions, also known as brainstorming. And again, these are excellent ideas to manage and resolve conflict. Come up with some creative ways to solve the problem, to meet the needs, to synchronize the expectations. Step five, evaluate the solutions and choose the best one. And in some cases, partners will come up with solutions, and then they can't choose one, and then they get back to step one because now they have another problem that they've generated the solutions, and they can't agree to the one that they should pick. So you can see this seven steps has some type of cutbacks or circlebacks that are involved, because at each step, you may not be able to get past a step, and then that would generate another conflict point that you'd have to go back and now say, now there's two issues we need to resolve. So step five, evaluate the possible solutions and choose one. Step six, implement a solution. Try something. Try multiple things if the first one doesn't work. So check it out by following up, saying, hey, you know what? we both thought this would work, but honestly, it's not working. Let's try again. And again, that doesn't mean that's bad, because a lot of times the first thing that you think of. So getting back to my illustration about time spent with one another. So I want more time, you want less time, we come up with something that says, I don't know, you know, 50% of the time you spend with me. And we say, okay, 50% of the time. And then after a while, the other partner says, you know what, 50s is too much. And then you start thinking about it and you're like, yeah, you know what, it is too much now that I think about it, now that we've tried it or whatever. Let's go back to kind of the way it was, or maybe 40%. So you could see where trying a solution and trying various solutions and then following up and be honest about this entire process. So this is the end of chapter 12. Please read, check your understanding questions. They could be essay questions for exams. And of course, the terms you should know and memorize, get to know. That's on page 394 and 395. So, to recap, this is part 3 of chapter 12, and this is Professor Tufano, and I'm out. Thanks.